Friday, 5 p.m. Congratulations, we made it. Time for another hour of American Hit Radio.
Holy moly.
Yeah. Didn't seem very possible on Monday or Tuesday, did it? But we are here. We made it to Friday, the end of Friday, 5 p.m. Happy hour, folks. So let's enjoy it the next hour here with American Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, and extraordinary engineer, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well.
Nice.
And of course, the Friday series is How Music Changed, where we discuss a whole variety of different topics in depth, trying to cover pretty much the entire history of recorded music. And right now we're back at a point in time that is circa 1930. I think that's about exactly where we're picking up, actually. We've been dedicating the past, this series of shows
to the Gershwins.
The Gershwins, the Gershwin brothers, George and Ira, and their incredible contribution to music. We've done 7 one-hour programs so far. This is number 8. And this is the show that brings us into the 30s. Up until this point, I believe that we were in the 20s. And at this point in time, there are a few things that are brewing, as always, really, with these two guys, the way that their life was going. Despite their extraordinary success, the Gershwin brothers remained ambitious and wanted to take on projects that presented a challenge to them. Now, for George, this meant writing more serious long-form pieces, which he had already done, and he wanted to continue to do, finding new formats. While at the same time, he and Ira were also attempting to change the very nature of musical comedy on Broadway by writing music for shows that actually had political undertones. Now, these plays did not generate hits as Gershwin was used to, but the shows themselves displayed a perspective that went considerably beyond the standard boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back sort of storyline. It was around this time that George even started to set his sights on composing an opera. So I think that these are all the things that we will be discussing. Now, as we ended our previous show, series number 7 dedicated to the Gershwins, we had discussed the first of 3 shows that were of a kind from this era. It was a show called Strike Up the Band. Strike Up the Band was the first of his shows that George conducted on opening night. As Isaac Goldberg observed, quote, George conducts with a baton, with his cigar, with his shoulders, with his hips, with his eyes, with whatnot, yet without any antics for the eyes of the audience. It is, rather, a gentle polyrhythm of his entire body. Nothing but a sense of propriety keeps him from leaping over the footlights and getting right into the show himself. Now, none of the songs, like I said, from Strike Up the Band became a hit, but I found a rather unusual recording of one of the songs. Actually, it's really unusual because it's recorded by Bob Dylan.
Huh.
So I figured I'd play Dylan's version of this song entitled Soon.
Thank you.
come soon. Let's make that day come soon.
Obviously, a live recording of Dylan recording a George and Ira tune. I just can't help but wonder if George Gershwin rolls over in his grave every time that version is played, because it's very much not representative of the way that Gershwin wrote it. But I do think that, it's great to basically show the versatility of the music. Throughout the show, I'm going to be doing some reading, so this is a good time to bring up the fact that there's a book called Fascinating Rhythm, The Collaborations of George and Ira Gershwin, and it's written by Dina Rosenberg. It's been very helpful to me in choosing songs and in getting some of the information that I needed for this series. So I'll be reading from that here at this point. Between Strike Up the Band and their second political operetta of Thee I Sing, the Gershwins went west to work on one of Hollywood's early musicals, Delicious, in 1931, with a screenplay by Guy Bolton and Sonia Levien. In it, they effectively mingled elements of musical comedy and satiric operetta with cinematic devices to create one of the more interesting early musical talkies. Delicious is about Heather, a poor immigrant from Scotland, played by Janet Gaynor, who became enamored of a rich young American, played by Charles Farrell. There is a serious side to the story concerning such themes as the problems of newly arrived immigrants and the loneliness of city life. Heather starts out with the fantasy of a fairy tale America. She is quickly disabused, is almost deported, and is on the run throughout most of the picture. Although she is ultimately rescued by her rich boyfriend, we see a good deal of the dark side of her experience. In a departure from the new musical screen, or old musical stage, conventions of their time, the Gershwins set Heather's two main dramatic scenes to music. First is the dream Heather has the night before her ship docks in New York Harbor. It is the classic dream of how most immigrants hope America will be. Welcome to the Melting Pot is written in the Gershwins' comic operetta vein, and the dream setting allows a stream of humorous free association in song. Heather is greeted at the gangplank by a team of reporters and eight Uncle Sams who welcome her to the Melting Pot. They are joined by Mr. Ellis of Ellis Island with the Statue of Liberty at his side and the mayor of New York with the key to the city, who welcomes Heather warmly in song as dollar bills fall from the sky. The music and lyrics, spread over 8 minutes of dream action, have several Gershwin in-jokes. For instance, when the reporters ask Heather how she likes America, her response is in Gershwinese, "Swonderful, smarvelous." The music, like much of Thee I Sing, is reminiscent of patriotic anthems spiked with blue twists. In the morning, the pleasant dream, a wish-come-true elaboration of Heather's last waking thoughts, is rudely interrupted by immigration officers. Heather dodges them, but later, at the picture's climax, Heather has a wide-awake nightmare as she runs from the police against a background of evocative music. It is an abbreviated version of George's second Rhapsody for piano and orchestra, written especially for the film, which the composer first called Manhattan Rhapsody, then New York Rhapsody, then Rhapsody in Rivets. Just before the scene starts, Heather's composer friend, Misha, seated at the piano, is demonstrating different musical motifs from his own new work, explaining to Heather that each motif represents another aspect of the city, the skyline made up of great towers almost in the clouds, human seeds trying to grow to the light. The musical theme also opened the first dream. Riveters drumming your ears from every side, the night motive silencing the rivets. The police knock at the door looking for Heather, who slips out the back and runs. The motifs Misha had played and described are then woven together as a musical underpinning to scraps of dialogue and city noises as Heather darts through the streets of New York, encountering a series of frightening strangers, feeling totally lost. Finally, terrified, she turns herself in. The use of the second rhapsody to illuminate a frightened young girl's impressions of an exciting but overwhelming metropolis represents one of the earliest and most original examples of musical underscoring on film. A New York Rhapsody had been in George's mind for some time. As he told a reporter in 1929, "I have sometimes thought of writing a piece in which I should like to embody the spirit of the city as I feel it, inspired, though, not by New York's great buildings and the vastness which makes up the city physically, but rather the spirit behind it all, the spiritual qualities that are really the intangible foundation of all we see and hear now. A native New Yorker, like myself, could delve down into the spirit of New York and find there the seed of a profound musical idea." Here, then, as performed by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, is George Gershwin's Second Symphony. Rhapsody, excuse me.
Thank you.
it is then, the Second Rhapsody, which bears sort of a passing resemblance to, I feel, Rhapsody in Blue, its precursor. Obviously, you could tell they're written by the same person, that's for sure. Now, while the Gershwins were still in Hollywood working on the film Delicious, they received a 5,000-word outline of a new show from the writers for Strike Up the Band, their previous show, George S. Kaufman and Maury Riskind. It was called Of Thee I Sing. Now, Strike Up the Band had made the Gershwins eager to do more unconventional and challenging musicals. Songs in the musical comedies of the 20s were almost all of the same length, verses of around 16 bars, refrains of 32, lasting 2 to 4 minutes, and were mostly used to heighten emotional moments or to create atmosphere. The plots, such as they were, usually stopped when the characters sang. In Strike Up the Band, the Gershwins used many other forms besides 32-bar songs, which is exactly why I wasn't able to play too much of it, unless I was going to basically play parts of the script, so it didn't make sense. In Of Thee I Sing, the Gershwins went farther. The show has more sung scenes than spoken ones, with music and lyrics of diverse lengths and styles that flow naturally from one to the next, carrying the action forward and giving color and dimension to characters who might otherwise be stick figures. Even the few songs in the score that can stand alone are also integral to the dramatic structure of the work. After providing the more upbeat 1920s with a musical catchphrase, "O Lady, Be Good to Me," the Gershwins wrote another for the 1930s, "Of Thee I Sing, Baby." "Of Thee I Sing," while good-natured, has a new feeling for social comment, a remarkable accomplishment in light music, in Oscar Levin's words. Oddly enough, though, while Of Thee I Sing was the first musical to win the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, the award went only to Kaufman and Riskind for the book, and Ira, then age 35, for the lyrics, not to George.
Interesting.
Before that was at a time when they figured that they didn't recognize music as a success, a successful musical is essential to making the book and the lyrics work. So they gave them credit for what was the text, for the Pulitzer part of it, and that George didn't get credit for the music. What I do have here is the overture from that operetta. So here is the overture from Of Thee I Sing.
Writer of the famous Rhapsody in Blue, Of Thee I Sing, and countless individual melodies and pieces, together with no less than 37 musical comedy scores, Mr. Gershwin occupies a commanding position in several creative fields. It is now the great privilege of Phenomen to introduce this vital, interesting personality, Mr. George Gershwin.
Good evening. Don Wilson said that these programs were to be intimate reviews of modern music. I'm afraid that's a rather large order. Personally, I should have felt safer if he had said that the programs were to be informal, for that is certainly what my part in them will be. I want you to feel as though you had simply dropped in at my house or I at yours to run over a few tunes that may have given us pleasure. As a starter, we ask the orchestra to give us the overture from Of Thee I Sing. Thank you.
I'd like to thank George Gershwin for his very entertaining introduction to that track, which was the overture from The I Sing. Let me remind you that you are listening to American Hit Radio, the Friday edition, which we call How Music Changed, on WHPC 90.3. I'm Tom Ryan. I'm your host on Wednesdays and Fridays from 5 until 6 with my lovely wife and co-host, Hattie Morales Ryan, manning the boards and basically keeping me straight and on track in case I misspeak every now and then, which I'm prone to do. How am I doing so far?
You're doing okay.
Okay, good. I'm trying to just make sure you keep me honest.
You know I do.
Now, playwrights Kaufman and Riskind found that you know, conceived an idea that allowed them to unfold a musical comedy-type love story and satirically comment on it at the same time. The revised story begins at the presidential nominating convention of the party out of power. Having no platform to bring before a disgruntled electorate, the party's power brokers persuade bachelor candidate John P. Wintergreen to run for office on a platform of love. An Atlantic City beauty contest will select the most beautiful girl in America. Wintergreen will then propose to her in every state in the union, and, if elected, will marry her at the inauguration. Complications ensue as Wintergreen falls in love with a campaign worker named Mary Turner and refuses to marry the contest winner, Diana Devereaux. He campaigns with Mary at his side, and they are swept into office. In Act Two, Devereaux induces the French government, she also claims to be of French descent, to all but declare war on the United States for Wintergreen's breach of promise. As the Senate is about to impeach Wintergreen, whose popularity has dwindled, he is saved by Mary's announcement that she is going to have a baby. All is resolved when Wintergreen realizes that since he cannot fulfill his duty to marry Devereaux, that task falls to the vice president, Alexander Throttlebottom. So there you've got the general idea for the script. And it's essentially the entire thing is sung. So it's basically the only way to play excerpts again would be to get deep into the story, which I don't think would be quite appropriate since this show about Gershwin is mostly about the music that people do remember these days as mostly whether it's the hits or the serious music. However, there's an exception to each rule, and Of the I Sing is just that, a campaign song and a love song, the candidate's pièce de résistance, so to speak. Although the song is introduced in the show as a campaign device, it unfolds as an affecting double entendre sort of ballad, a love song to a woman and a nation. Deliberately, with expression, Wintergreen voices his love for Mary and for his country. This particular double meaning begins with the title, which is also the song's first line, a well-known patriotic platitude, at once personalized and somewhat sent up by the addition of the word baby. Here, then, as sung by Ella Fitzgerald, is Of Thee I Sing, Baby.
From the island of Manhattan to the coast of gold, from north to south, from east to west, you are the love I love the best. You're the dreamboat in the sweetest story ever told, a dream I sought both night and day. For years through all the USA, the star I've hitched my wagon to is very obviously you. Of thee I sing. Summer, autumn, winter, spring, baby, you're my silver lining. You're my sky of blue. There's a love light shining just because of you. Of thee I sing, baby. You have got that certain star and inspiration, worthy of a mighty nation. Of thee I
I say that most of these plays didn't really have too much in the way of individual songs that stood on their own. That song certainly does. And there's one other from Of Thee I Sing that I'd like to play that I believe stands on its own. Who Cares is definitely one of the greatest Gershwin songs and among their own favorites. It makes a big impact in Of Thee I Sing, in part because there is no other song like it in the score. In Who Cares, George used blue notes and harmonies to do more than augment, undermine, and make the music more poignant, as he had on past songs. A whole rich substratum of modern, elusive jazz and blue note sprinkled harmonies is continuously audible, capturing the more complex demands of the dramatic situation and the more somber tone of the period. Who Cares is charged with the unusual double duty of being first a political device and then, almost immediately, a heartfelt ballad. Moreover, it is a ballad affirming the possibility of love in a specific time when banks were failing and the economy collapsing. By the winter of 1931-1932, the American sky effectively was, to quote the lyric, falling into the sea. The unsettling harmonies of Who Cares acknowledge the difficult search for stability at that time, as though the earth were constantly shifting beneath any attempt to construct a personal life. The lyric and melody to Who Cares mark a transition for George and Ira from the repeated melodic and lyric wisps of many of their 20s ballads. Who Cares combines the succinctness of the title with a longer angular melody and complete sentences rather than exclamations in the lyric. There is room in the music and lyric for pauses and a plaintive violin obbligato the second time the song is sung, but the song is not based on repeated fragments. It drives forward to its last line, which turns the question of the title into an affirmation. To perform it, I found a rather credible version by Mr. Tony Bennett.
Let it rain and thunder. Let a million firms go under. I am not concerned with stocks and bonds that I've been burned with. I love you and you love me, and that's how it was meant to be. And nothing else will ever mean a thing. Who cares what the public chatters? Love cares if the sun in the sky fails to shine? Who cares if banks fail in Yonkers? As long as you've got that kiss that conquers, why should I try? Life is one long jubilee, as long as you care for me, and I care for you. Why should I try? Life is one long jubilee, as long as you care for me, and I care for you.
Wow. Thank you, Tony Bennett. So then, just as the Gershwins wrote the first version of Strike Up the Band while still heavily involved in writing lighter musical comedies, so George began to prepare to write his first opera in the midst of writing satiric operettas. First, he started taking composition lessons in early 1932 with Joseph Schillinger. Could you imagine having George Gershwin as a student?
That's probably pretty crazy.
Right. Joseph Schillinger was a fairly well-known music theorist who applied mathematical principles to musical composition, and George hoped to increase his dexterity at manipulating melodies and rhythms so as to sustain musical continuity and interest in an extended work. But meanwhile, more concert works and musicals ensued. In May 1932, Random House published a songbook of 18 of George's favorites, from Nobody But You in 1919 to Who Cares, the song we just played from 1931, each printed in a popular sheet music arrangement, followed by a more complex piano version in the style of George's own improvisations. Unfortunately, he wrote in an introduction to the songbook, most songs die at an early age and are soon completely forgotten by the selfsame public that once sang them with such gusto. The reason for this is that they are sung and played too much when they are alive, and cannot stand the straining of their very popularity. Hence, this songbook and the special arrangements to give the songs a longer life. It is interesting that George did not think that his songs would live on their own as songs. In his essay, George went on to cite several early 20th century popular and ragtime pianists, black and white, as prominent influences. What he neglected to mention, and perhaps did not realize, was that since the mid-1920s, he had also been incorporating classical influences into his piano playing, which, as Dick Hyman and Artis Wodehouse have pointed out, can be heard in his piano rolls and recordings of the 20s. The Debussy-esque harmonies that are evident in Of Thee I Sing, and which George acknowledged in An American in Paris, had been creeping into his piano improvising for years, though often not into the printed sheet music, and they are apparent in many of the songbook transcriptions. Now, in the winter of 1933, George moved to a duplex at 132 East 72nd Street. Ira moved across the street, and later that year, the Gershwins, with Kaufman and Riskind, wrote Let 'Em Eat Cake, the third of their operettas and a sequel to Of Thee I Sing. If Strike Up the Band was a satire on war, and Of Thee I Sing, one on politics, Let 'Em Eat Cake was a satire on practically everything, Ira wrote in 1959. Straddling no fence, it trampled the extreme right one moment, the extreme left the next. Kaufman and Riskind's libretto was at times wonderfully witty, at other times unrelentingly realistic in its criticism of the then American scene. Ira goes on, possibly the following short musical speech, which was unused, written for the professional agitator Kruger, gives an indication of what Let 'Em Eat Cake strove for. Conditions as they were must never recur. Whatever is, shouldn't be. Whatever isn't, should. Whatever wasn't, will be. And I'm arranging it all for your good. It was almost like this was like the time when Hitler was coming into rise. And Ira was actually, you know, basically wrote a song for a, he wrote a the following passage, Song for a Nazi Musical Comedy.
Wow.
Right? Hitler puts a ban on Negro music and calls for the return of the waltz. And then he wrote, Opponents, we griddle, we cut up the yiddle in three-quarter time. Or a book review, you know, My Battle, Mein Kampf, in other words, of Germany and her many, well, minds. None's littler than Hitler, one finds. Unfortunately, this show did not do very well at all. Let 'Em Eat Cake was probably too much for the time. And it contained literally no songs that could be separated from the text. It was all written as one very long piece. So, you know, that's one reason. And another reason for the show's early demise may have been that the score was too sophisticated for Broadway. It had almost no extractable songs that would stand on their own, like I said, outside of their original context. But I do have the overture. And it's an interesting one. It's actually performed by Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops Orchestra. So we'll go out with that by playing the overture from Let 'Em Eat Cake. Thanks, everybody, and I hope you have a great weekend. And Heidi and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Good night.